This is 91.3 KUAF, your home for not just NPR News for more than 32 years, but for great music on programs like Of Note with Katie Henriksen and The Generic Blues Show with Paul Kelso. You can find schedules for all of our stations at KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, August 17th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on our show today, the Arkansas Education Television Network is preparing for a major rollout of Ken Burns' documentary series about the Vietnam War next month. AETN will have a series of programs on TV and in person around the state. We'll have a preview a bit later. First, more history. The Apollo has been a fixture on Springdale's Emma Avenue for decades. After being closed for years, the building is reopening to the public today as a rental venue. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Earlier this month, men were hard at work on the renovation of the old Apollo movie theater building in downtown Springdale. In 2014, the condemned structure was purchased for $50,000 by Brian Moore and Tom Lindstrom, who says the building means a lot to longtime Springdale residents.
We're real excited to be able to bring this little piece of history back to life.
The Apollo was originally owned by William Sonneman. Susan Young, outreach coordinator at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, says Sonneman moved to Northwest Arkansas from Texas in 1925 and at one point owned all four movie theaters in Fayetteville.
So for a time, he was like the king of movie theaters in Fayetteville and Springdale. Well, then in 1948, he divested himself of the Fayetteville theaters. He sold them to Malco and said, but I'm going to keep my Springdale movie theaters. At that time, he had two movie theaters on downtown Emma Avenue, the Concord and the Shiloh. He said in 1948, he announced that he was going to build the grandest theater that Northwest Arkansas had ever seen in Springdale.
The result was the Apollo, which opened in 1949.
By all estimates, it was truly the most wondrous movie theater in Northwest Arkansas. It had staggered seating, you know, where you're not looking at the back of somebody's head. It had extra wide seats. It had a glassed-in private room for private parties if you wanted to invite folks in and have your own room to sit in. The lobby was the thing. The lobby was furnished with beautiful antiques, and at the center of the lobby was this beautiful marble statue of the god Apollo.
Young says there are two stories of how the statue found its home in the theater. Both involve a Springdale antiques dealer named Dallas Barack.
Sonneman's movie theater manager, whose name was Max Cox, had gone into Dallas Barack's antique studio, antique gallery, and seen this incredible statue, this incredible marble statue of the god Apollo. And that Max Cox came back to Mr. Sonneman and said, well, you need to go down to Dallas Barack's gallery and see that statue. It's something else. So the story is that when Bill Sonneman saw this statue, he was so taken with it. I want that for my movie theater, my new theater, and we'll name the theater the Apollo. That's one story. The variation of the story is Dallas Barack, the antiques dealer, knew he had this glamorous statue and he wanted to unload it. And he did, who's going to buy this statue? So he went to Sonneman and said, you know what, this would look great in your new movie palace.
Regardless of which story is more accurate, one certainty is the statue was a fixture in the lobby of the movie theater, which became a part of the memories of several local residents, like City Councilman Jim Reed, who worked at the Apollo as a boy.
I started actually working in the Apollo Theater. I've been thinking about this when I was about 14 because I wasn't driving yet. As a bouncer. So I had to walk the halls with the flashlight, you know, and make sure there wasn't people making out in the rows and, you know, stuff like that.
Reed says it was an enjoyable time and he got to meet a lot of people. While employed at the Apollo, he learned to operate the projector and splice film. He climbed up and down a ladder to change the marquee one letter at a time and was even used as a prop during a sci-fi movie.
And at one point in the movie, it looked like the bad thing was jumping out of the screen into the audience. And they sent masks around with big old flash bulbs. And there was myself on one side of the stage and another young man on the other side of the stage with those masks on. And when they jumped out of the screen, we flashed those. And we started running through the audience. And we had people running everywhere. It was so fun.
Reed also learned how to run the concession stand, which had a unique drink on the menu.
Of course, the one thing I'll never forget about the Apollo Theater is pickle juice. They served dill pickle juice, I want to say for a nickel a cup, and everybody loved it. Everybody loved it.
During its heyday in the 1950s and 60s, Susan Young with the Shiloh Museum says popcorn balls were also a staple snack for guests.
And there was a Springdale guy named Dale Gilmore who got a patent, who invented a machine that would make popcorn balls. And this became Mr. Sonneman's movie theater treat, signature thing, popcorn balls and pickle juice over crushed ice.
Bill Sonneman died in 1969 at the age of 92. By that time, he was retired, and once he'd left, the Apollo was never the same. In the 1970s, the theater began showing X-rated movies, and it was shut down in 1975 after being charged with showing an obscene film. Young says for a time, there were several attempts to use the venue as a music theater, but nothing was ever quite as successful as Mr. Sonneman's original movie palace. Until a recent push to revitalize downtown Springdale, Young says the Apollo was just an interesting old building that you'd hear a lot of stories about.
People talking about this statue is what led me to even become intrigued about it at all. People saying, you know, the old ladies in town thought that statue was obscene. They thought he ought to be covered up in a cloak. And other folks saying, yeah, you know, the teenage boys would go in there with their cigarettes, and Apollo had this pose where one of his hands is kind of, his fingers are kind of set apart, so they'd stick the cigarette in Apollo's hand. And just, you know, it's just a colorful part of our local history, that statue.
Young decided to learn more about the statue's history. Her research started on Facebook, which led her to Sonneman's granddaughter in Little Rock, who said the statue was given to a Fayetteville attorney as payment for representing the movie owner and projectionist at the time of the 1975 trial for obscenity.
Sadly, Richard Womack, the attorney, had passed away by the time I was looking for him a couple of years ago. But luckily, he had named his son after himself. So when I Google Richard Womack attorney, I find a Richard Womack II, an attorney in Nashville, Tennessee. Gotta be. So I call him. I emailed him first. Said, you know, this may seem a little random, but there's Apollo statue, your dad, blah, blah. He emails me back and says, oh, that statue's sitting here in my office. We always called him David. We thought he was David. We didn't know he was Apollo.
Young's research serves as a reminder of how small towns can be full of big, interesting histories.
This is a great example of the joy, the utter joy, the geeky utter joy of doing local history research and finding extraordinarily colorful and entertaining and interesting stories on what appears could be the most mundane of things, a small town movie theater. I mean, you know, what could be exciting about that, right?
You can learn more about Springdale's colorful past by visiting the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And for details about the Apollo's future, you can visit theapollooniemma.com. Later on today's Ozarks, a new book recounts some nearly forgotten stories of Black athletes and Arkansas.
Before he was Houston Nuts quarterback coach at Little Rock Central, he was the head coach at Menifee in basketball, and he ends up kind of breaking racial barriers by taking an all-Black team and playing against all-white competition as the first Arkansas Activity Association Black coach, essentially.
Evan Day Morrell talks about his just-published book, African-American Athletes in Arkansas. That's ahead on today's Ozarks.
A virtual private network, or VPN, is like a dark secret tunnel that runs between your computer and a website. They've gotten much more popular since Congress repealed privacy rules.
This change allows U.S. ISPs to collect 100% of your web browsing and sell it to third parties.
I'm Audie Cornish. VPNs that promise privacy but don't always deliver. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 3 to 6 on 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. 91.3 KUAF is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. The Alma Performing Arts Center presents the U.S. Navy Band Cruisers this Friday at 7 p.m. This contemporary entertainment ensemble performs music genres ranging from jazz standards, rhythm and blues, classic rock, pop, and more. This Friday's free event requires tickets. AlmaPAC.org or 632-2129.
The city of Rogers is looking to annex just shy of 4,000 acres of unincorporated land on the east and west sides of Highway 112. Mayor Greg Hines called the three pieces of land on the east side of the highway islands because they're already mostly surrounded by Rogers.
Many of those folks think they live in the city of Rogers and believe they're serviced by Rogers. So that's more of a cleanup issue.
The land on the west side of Highway 112 is much larger, nearly 3,500 acres. Mayor Hines says already there have been a number of voluntary annexations along Haxton Road in that area, including the Scissortail subdivision and land that was purchased by the Bentonville School District for an elementary school within the Rogers city limits. Mayor Hines says those two annexations push the conversation forward on whether to annex the entire parcel of land.
It really just makes more sense as a city to look at what is really the area of land that we would be willing, capable, and able to serve. And this area that we talk about west of 112 is in the water service boundary area that's already been established through the municipalities and other water providers. And so we really just kind of drew lines around that and have said that's kind of where Rogers can go to the west. That's as far west as we'll ever go.
Mayor Hines says it would cost the city less to extend water and sewer services to the entire area instead of doing it in a piecemeal way every time someone comes to the city with a voluntary annexation. And the mayor says the unincorporated areas wouldn't just get water and sewer.
You know, these folks overnight, if and when this election passes, will have immediate police protection, will have immediate fire protection. You know, we're an ISO 1 rating out in the county. They may not even have an ISO rating, or they may be a 6 or 7. So to go from a 6 or 7 to a 1, they're going to save a tremendous amount of money on their homeowner's insurance and any type of other insurance that they're required to keep on structures in that area.
Trash and street services will also be extended into the annexed areas. All that, though, means property taxes will also increase. The city's 3.8 mills will apply to those areas that will now be within city limits. The individual total millage rate for each homeowner will further depend on which school district the property is located inside of. Mayor Hines says right now, a lot of the land west of Highway 112 is farmland, and the annexation won't affect any farming operations. As far as what happens in the future, the mayor says that will be up to the landowners, although he expects most of the area to stay residential should it be annexed.
Having grown up here, if you'd have taken me out to the Rife Farm when I was shooting doves and said there's going to be Pinnacle Promenade Mall, I'd have tried to have you locked up because you're crazy. So we don't know for sure, but I think the idea is that we're really the only one that can serve them. It falls within our established water service boundary. It makes sense. It's inevitable to happen anyway.
The Rogers City Council still has to vote to approve the special election. The item will be on the agenda at next Tuesday's meeting. That meeting is held at City Hall at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday. If the City Council approves the measure to annex land east and west of Highway 112, the special election would be held November 14th. Voting would include the residents of Rogers, as well as all of those living in the unincorporated areas that have been proposed for annexation. If you have any questions or comments regarding the city's plans, you can send an email to cityservices@rogersar.gov or attend next week's city council meeting.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA.
I used to take showers as a kid. We'd have to fill up a bucket, and then that was the water I used to shower. You couldn't tell from looking at it the levels of arsenic.
We hear about how some Coachella Valley residents don't have access to clean water. That's this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA, Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, right before Weekend All Things Considered, on 91.3 KUAF. Arkansas's success in sports, well known. The 1964 football championship, the 94 March Madness run, trophy after trophy for the U of A track program, and then pro stars like Dizzy Dean, Torrey Hunter, and renowned jockey Pat Day. But as is the case with history, many intriguing stories fade from the popular memory or may not have ever been widely known at all. Evan DeMorel collects many examples of such stories in his just-published book, African American Athletes in Arkansas, Muhammad Ali's Tour, Black Razorbacks, and Other Forgotten Stories. He's been on our program before discussing some of the subjects that are included in the new book, but not nearly all of them. He writes of the barnstorming baseball teams of Negro League baseball stars like Satchel Paige coming to Fort Smith to play a local team of African American players.
It's just amazing the amount of talent that would come down to Fort Smith and just essentially play for the love of the game. I mean, I'm sure they made a little money playing in front of the crowds at that time, but it wasn't anything like the money they could have made going to a bigger city.
Right. And it was often, you ask in the interview that you include in the book, you asked George McGill, I mean, do you remember hearing that any white teams would play black teams mm-hmm. or there would be mixed teams? He said, no, it was pretty much African-American teams playing African-American teams.
Pretty much African-American teams, for the most part, yes. And also, importantly, there was no interracial teams.
Right.
Black and whites right. on the same team. However, he does bring up a story I'd never heard before or seen recorded, and that was in the early 40s, maybe late 1930s. George's doesn't remember exactly, but he was saying his father at that time went up with this group of ball players to play a team, all white team out of Fayetteville. And so they go up to Fayetteville and they end up playing a fun game. But interestingly, one of the farmers up here in Fayetteville goes to George's dad and I think he's drunk at this point, but he's telling him
the farmer
is, yes. And he says, you boys better win because we've bet on you. And if you win, we're going to give you all the moonshine you can handle. So they actually win. George's father's team wins the game and they don't have a clear practice for the next week.
I love when you're talking to him because it's sort of this dichotomy. On one hand, it's sad because sports involving African-American mm-hmm. athletes before a certain era were not as recorded mm-hmm. as the games with the white players. Mm-hmm. Just didn't have the mainstream press or whatever. So you lose some details. On the other hand, I love the idea of legend. Mm-hmm. And when you ask George McGill, so did your dad's team win? I love because you've got it verbatim.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. Well, I don't know if they did. Uh-huh. You know, I was told they uh-huh. did. There was uh-huh. even a bit of doubt in his mind. Did they really beat Satchel Paige uh-huh. and these guys? And the legend is his father picked a runner off first.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which I love the fact Satchel. That there's something about me that loves not knowing for sure whether that was the ending, because that's a great ending.
That's true. I mean, we are that's a very optimistic way to look at it.
Yeah,
in that way of looking at it, we're almost in a golden age of if we can get these stories while we can, not only from the old timers who are there living, but sometimes just their younger siblings or their sons or daughters, they too can be interviewed and recorded. And that in itself is valuable.
Did you feel an urgency with this book, trying to get some of the stories that took place decades ago?
Oh, no question. I mean, that's a main reason I decided to self-publish this book is I knew the faster I got it out, and by fast, I meant like a year.
Yeah.
Then the better for trying to get word out about this mission and hopefully building on it and seeing if we can't take this to, you know, into a bigger sphere. But, I mean, there were, a couple University of Arkansas Press was interested and Butler Center was interested in this idea, but it would have taken much longer.
The basketball team in Little Rock, the Jesters?
The Hilarious Jesters.
The Hilarious Jesters.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
So Hilarious Jesters is a frankly, it was the name itself kind of like opened up. Who were these guys? I ran across mention of them in Untold Stories, a Democrat Gazette anthology from about 14 years ago. But they were, it appears, the first integrated adult basketball team in Central Arkansas, potentially the state. I'm not sure, but I thought it was an interesting story because there's two protagonists here. There's a guy named Chester Lane, who is the original founder and organizer of the team. He's African-American of Little Rock. Then there's a guy named Dave McPherson, a white guy who had played basketball while in the Army in France and played in interracial teams in the 50s. So even though growing up he went to what is now Little Rock Central High and it was segregated, he had no problem playing against blacks, in part because of that experience in France. So in the late 1950s, they just kind of randomly happened to meet each other on a court in downtown Little Rock, shooting around. They just start playing one-on-one. And they from that, they develop a bond, and they start kind of conscripting some of their friends, other high-level players. There's one guy, a white player who, Wayne Yates, who from North Little Rock, who'd go on to play for the Los Angeles Lakers. He'd come down and kind of scrimmage with them at Philander Smith College. Geese Osby, you know, was a guy who would scrimmage. They played against Eddie Miles mm-hmm. at the time. So it's very high level, Division One future pro type players. And they took some of these guys. I would say the team ended up being about one-third white, two-thirds black, kind of different members year to year. But through the early 1960s, they would play not only in Little Rock, but they would play in like places like Conway, mm-hmm. Mostly all white crowds, or Searcy, Northeast Arkansas, all white crowds. And then they go down south, southeast, they'd go to like Altimer or England or Pine Bluff, and they would play against mostly black crowds,
right,
in front of mostly black crowds. And so I thought it was an interesting story because you kind of got a sense of there were some so-called white pioneers here. I mean, white guys who broke racial barriers in a way by going and playing on majority black teams in front of majority black crowds, and they got rousing too. So I think the ball bounced both ways sometimes when it came to integration.
We've highlighted some of the stories of whites and blacks playing together in front of crowds that might not expect that. Unfortunately, there are more stories about black athletes from Arkansas, and the stories are about being unable to play where they should have been able to play and having to really sacrifice a lot to point out the inequities. I think of some of the – we've talked about it in an earlier conversation mm-hmm. on this program, but some of the players who had to protest and perhaps lose careers mm-hmm. to try to advance it for the people who had come behind them.
Right, yeah, like a guy like Ivy Moore,
yeah.
Pine Bluff native who played for the Wyoming Cowboys in the late 1960s. At the time, Wyoming actually was on the cusp of being a kind of a mid-major powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
They were a trending program, and they were, like, I think they were ranked in the top 15 the year Ivy Moore was junior, and he had a group of really strong African-American players on that Cowboys team. A few of them went on to play in the NFL. And in the middle of that season, they decide, you know, we're going to take a stand. We're going to take a stand against BYU, because BYU at the time did not allow blacks to become ministers in their church. And that had kind of sparked strikes within athletic programs in places like on the West Coast, in Stanford, and those kind of places. And that had spread. The Wyoming football players kind of took up the cause, and they decided, we're going to sit out against essentially, we're going to make a stand and do it against in the BYU team. The coach of the Wyoming Cowboys at the time did not support the player, unlike the coach of the Missouri Tigers.
Just a couple of years ago.
He did support their protests. This coach did not in 1969. They never play another game for the Cowboys program. And except for like a brief surge in the 80s, the Wyoming football really has never recovered thoroughly from that event. These kind of guys just need to be more well-known. Eddie Boone's another one.
Yeah.
Houston Nutt's quarterback coach who before he was Houston Nutt's quarterback coach at Little Rock Central, he was the head coach at Menifee in basketball, and he ends up kind of breaking racial barriers by taking an all-black team and playing against all-white competition as the first Arkansas Activity Association black coach, essentially.
I also think that there are a lot of small towns, not just in Arkansas, but around the country, have their hometown legends,
mm-hmm.
guys that maybe didn't go on to stellar careers in college, let alone pros, but were great and helped win a state championship or a great run in a small town. There are some of the African-American prep players in Arkansas that maybe just don't achieve that sort of legendary status because of segregation. You know, that played at schools and aren't as remembered or as revered as some of their white counterparts.
Yeah, look at Bruce Fullerton.
Yeah.
I think he would be a primary example. Bruce Fullerton kind of was you know, an All-American running back for Little Rock Central High during the integration crisis in that era, in 1957. At the same time, that Central High team was the number one team in the nation, you know, ranked by some polls. So extremely good team. Fullerton ends up going to play for the Razorbacks a little bit. It doesn't really work out up here, and he never really achieves anything like he did in high school. But to this day, his legend endures in many parts of the state. And in part, that's just because you have so many records and memoirs and yearbooks that just praise him to high end, you know? It's deserved.
Right.
But at the same time, there's just so many books, so many yearbooks, so many records. It's not the same thing with most of these African Americans, outside, with an exception of Dunbar High School.
Mm-hmm.
Dunbar High School is a little different game in Little Rock in that it did have, it was very well funded, very well supported. It had a lot of yearbooks coming out of it. They even have a museum in Little Rock Central High. There you can kind of find books about Dunbar. Dunbar itself it's a junior high now, has a kind of an archive within it. That's an exception. Other than that school, there's not as much.
When you think of this era now, in the days of Torrey Hunter, mm-hmm. the Pine Bluff high school kid who went on to a stellar major league career, Sidney Moncrief, mm-hmm. really, I would say, is still arguably the most famous Razorback basketball player in history.
He has to be right there with a guy like Corliss.
Corliss won the national champ. Yeah. So
Sidney arguably maybe a bigger name because of his NBA success.
Right. I mean, yeah. You know, all-star, mm-hmm. defensive player of the year.
2 year times.
Right. It's hard to imagine with those figures, and I mentioned Moncrief and Hunter because they were Arkansas-born, mm-hmm. not just Arkansas Razorbacks, but natives of Arkansas. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that there was a time, not incredibly long ago, when we just, as a state, didn't want to include African-American athletes as part of our tapestry.
It's not to be taken for granted, the fact that the Razorback brand has become such a unifying force, as we can see with this outpouring of emotion for Frank Broyles. He was a big part of the reason it's unifying force. However, it is interesting to know that while you had guys like Eddie Miles, who were Razorback fans in the 50s, you had these African-American fans that we've talked about in the past in the 40s in Fayetteville, there were many African-Americans. This is just kind of anecdotally, and also through the memoir of Elin Harris, who in pre-integration in the 60s and 50s, they were not Razorback fans. These are Arkansas natives. Not Razorback fans. They're getting angry at their relatives when they're listening to the Razorback games on the radio.
Because they're segregated teams.
Exactly. It reminds them of what they don't have and the injustice of society. Of course, that changes when guys like Sidney come on the scene, John Richardson, Muskie Harris, Dirt Winston, you know, you go on and on with these guys in the late 60s and 1970s. And today, it's hard to imagine, you know, if you're black, you don't like the Razorbacks because of a race issue. I mean, it's
right.
Majority African-American now in basketball.
And yet, Evan, when someone 50 years from now mm-hmm. writes the update,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to imagine they will not be writing about the women's basketball season that was just completed because race became,
yes,
or racial issues, social issues became part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it always wasn't, I don't think it will be remembered necessarily always as a banner time in public discourse.
No.
Because when some of the players, I think all of the players who took a knee might have been African American.
Mm-hmm.
There were some ugly things said. So work to be done?
Work to be done, and also changing of dynamic. I mean, what guys like Ivy Moore went through was not easy in 1969. But their phones weren't blowing up with hate messages.
They didn't have Twitter messages.
They didn't have Twitter messages, and they didn't have phones in their pockets. And so I think I would say that the dynamic of what a player taking a stand today, whether you agree with the stand or not, it does take courage to take that stand and then live with the repercussions, because A lot of these women, their lives have been changed.
Evan DeMorel is the author of the just-published book, African American Athletes in Arkansas, Muhammad Ali's Tour, Black Razorbacks, and Other Forgotten Stories. He'll sign books Saturday afternoon from 4 until 6:30 and at the Fayetteville Barnes & Noble location a week from Saturday. He'll be at Nightbird Books in downtown Fayetteville September 7th and later at the Clinton School of Public Affairs in Little Rock. You can find out much more about the book at heritageofsports.com. And we'll hear more from the conversation Sunday morning on Weekend Ozarks at Large at 9 o'clock on 91.3 KUAF.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 2017 Fayetteville Roots Festival is August 23rd through the 27th. This festival of roots music, local food, and Ozark culture will feature a variety of free and ticketed community events in both Fayetteville and Bentonville. TheRootsFest.org for event schedule and more information.
And speaking of the Roots Festival, a week from tomorrow, the annual Ozarks at Large, Fayetteville Roots Festival, Fayetteville Public Library, KUAF collaboration, that is live radio, live from the Fayetteville Roots Festival in the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library. It's free. It's 2 hours of great entertainment. Here's who I'm going to tell you will definitely be there. Honey Dewdrop, scheduled to be there. Joe Purdy will be there. Mandolin Orange will be there. Plus, we're going to save some surprises, but some of the other folks who will be on the Friday night main stage at the Town Center as part of the festival will be there with us, as well as much more. That's Friday, a week from tomorrow, from noon until 2, live in the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library. It is absolutely free. Please be advised, it's a small room, so there aren't a lot of seats. And if you can't make it, or you get there too late, it will be live on the radio a week from tomorrow on 91.3 KUAF and Ozarks at Large, live from the Roots Festival, from the Fayetteville Public Library, 1 week from tomorrow on KUAF. See you there.
I'm Robin Young. 70 years ago this week, millions were violently displaced as India was split into two countries. NPR's Asia editor has a reading list of great books about partition.
Reading them today in 2017, the thing that struck me was how much it is like the world we're living in today with the global refugee crisis.
Next time, Here and Now.
At 1, right after Ozarks at Large on 91.3. Next month, PBS premieres Ken Burns' latest documentary series, The Vietnam War. The Arkansas Educational Television Network, AETN, has been gathering its own stories and remembrances from Arkansas Vietnam veterans with the help of Hot Springs Village Voice editor and oral historian Jeff Meek. Bobby Apazon with Arkansas Public Media reports.
Will you give us a mic check? Just say your name.
My name is George Hollingsworth.
Retired Staff Sergeant George Hollingsworth is not completely at ease on this makeshift television set inside Jeff Meek's home, but he acts cool. In Vietnam, it was his job to set up nighttime ambushes.
Get the platoon, wait until just before dark, set up the men, set up the Claymore mines.
Hollingsworth is one of 9 Vietnam War veterans from around Arkansas who are sharing their experiences for an AETN oral history series. Itself part of a larger broadcast and online rollout around Ken Burns' miniseries that premieres next month.
So that there would be a pretty serious kill zone, and that was just our routine. That was our day in, day out.
In Hot Springs Village on Thursday, there will be a screening of Ken Burns' Vietnam War, not the full 18-hour documentary, just an hour, along with highlights of Meek's interviews, and a panel discussion will follow it. AETN is doing this all around Arkansas, in Jonesboro Saturday, Little Rock next Tuesday, and Fayetteville, Fort Smith, and Jacksonville next month.
We've known that the Ken Burns documentary was coming for a long time, and the PBS system has been talking about it for years. And we realized that, yes, Ken Burns was going to get out there and talk about the overall impact of the Vietnam War, but we felt it was our obligation to get out there and find the Arkansas stories.
The Arkansas stories, like the Vietnam War itself, don't strike the same kinds of gallant chords that World War II does. There's no climactic D-Day invasion. There's no allies. The end is defeat. Burns himself has framed the war as the onset of an ailment that we suffer from today.
a good deal of what's wrong right now in terms of our inability to feel like that began. It was a virus planted somewhere in Vietnam, and that we're seeing the full fruits of that toxicity today.
The man behind the interviews, but in front of the camera, is Jeff Meek, a career gym teacher who has spent his retirement gathering stories. First war veteran oral histories, now newspaper features as managing editor of the Hot Springs Village Voice. Circulation, 5,000.
This is where I do most of my newspaper work, is right here. I'm allowed to work at home, so this is kind of Hot Springs Village Voice Central right here.
He got into collecting wartime oral histories years ago when his wife Jean's Daughters of the American Revolution chapter was looking for someone to do oral histories for the Veterans History Project.
You know, just think if we could interview Stonewall Jackson about the Civil War, or Ulysses S. Grant, or Robert E. Lee. I mean, that would be an interview any one of us would love to do, but you can't do it because they're gone.
In 2011, he collected 75 of these oral histories into a bound volume titled They Answered the Call, World War II Vets Share Their Stories. This project about Vietnam feels a lot different.
If you're a World War II veteran, you know why you were over there. The Vietnam veterans, I think some of them would say that we shouldn't have been there in the first place. I think some would say if they would have left us alone, we could have defeated North Korea and got it over. Many of them aren't real happy with politicians, even to this day, because it turned so political.
Hollingsworth, the retired staff sergeant, attributes the dissolution of two marriages to emotional fallout from the war. He was really angry, he says, for a long time. In a way, he was like the war itself.
Vietnam is a story that really needs to be told in an honest, non-judgmental fashion. There are things about that war that we still don't know how it has affected our country even. Like Jeff talks about, it has affected me all of my life. There'll never be a Vietnam veteran president. You know, we're now getting too old, for one thing. The vets are all too old, but everybody that's run that's a veteran, they're not going to be elected.
Why not?
That's just the case. I mean, I still don't think America as a country has worked out their issues with Vietnam.
Visit ArkansasPublicMedia.org for links to some of the Vietnam War projects, including a link to The Wall of Faces, an effort by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund to upload pictures of the more than 58,000 Americans killed in Southeast Asia. There's still about 168 Arkansans killed in the war and not pictured. Also, check out video highlights of retired Staff Sergeant George Hollingsworth's interview and an email address for Jeff Meek. In Hot Springs Village, I'm Bobby Ampazon, Arkansas Public Media.
Arkansas Public Media is a statewide journalism collaboration among public media organizations in Arkansas and is funded, in part, by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can learn more at ArkansasPublicMedia.org. Bobby Ampazon mentioned the upcoming public discussions around the state hosted by AETN. The Fort Smith event will be Tuesday, September 12th at the main Fort Smith Library on Rogers Avenue. And on Saturday, September 16th, I'll moderate a discussion at the Fayetteville Public Library that follows a screening of part of Ken Burns' documentary. The panel is scheduled to include Roy Reed, writer and former New York Times reporter, Colonel Karen Lloyd, director of Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, Jim Hale, a local Vietnam War veteran, and Randall Woods, author and University of Arkansas Distinguished American History Professor. That's on Saturday, September 16th, at the Fayetteville Public Library from 2 until 4. The program is free, and it's open to the public.
On the next Fresh Air, performer Bridget Everett. Her raunchy comedy cabaret act showcases her wild sexual humor, her beautiful singing voice, and her 6-foot-tall, plus-sized body. She's been featured on Amy Schumer's TV series and is in the new film Patty Cakes. Also actor John Cho, best known for his role in the Harold and Kumar comedies. Join us.
Fresh Air every weekday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. Just ahead on today's Ozarks at Large, it's this week's edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. And today, Chip Souza will talk with Paul Gatling about remembering Frank Broyles. coach, athletic director, fundraiser. That's just ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. Bob Livingston was a founding member of the legendary Lost Gonzo Band, and he played an integral role in helping to create the music that first earned Austin the designation of live music capital of the world. And he's a great storyteller. He'll be in concert tomorrow night at the Artist Retreat in Bella Vista, and then Saturday at the historic Ozark Mountain Smokehouse on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Fayetteville. If you'd like more information, 409-1224. And the University of Arkansas Department of Art is announcing the exhibition A New Subjectivity, Figurative Painting After 2000. The exhibit runs from the 21st of this month through September 22nd. A reception with the curator will take place August 31st. It's an exhibition composed entirely of paintings by women that attempts to categorize expressionism in new terms.
He was Georgia-born and Georgia-bred, but there has arguably never been a more iconic Arkansan than Frank Broyles. I'm Paul Gatling, and this is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. He was an intimidating figure, two of his former players recalled earlier this week, but Arkansas football coach Frank Broyles used that persona in a positive way to motivate his players and to eventually change for the better Arkansas's image in the world of collegiate athletics. The Georgia man who arrived in Arkansas in December of 1957 and never left died Monday in Fayetteville from complications due to Alzheimer's disease. Frank Broyles was 92. He's been remembered throughout the week here at home and throughout the nation, and the overwhelming consensus was that he had a positive and far-reaching impact on anything he touched and everyone he met. He had a special impact on many levels, and Arkansans will find it difficult to name a handful of people who held such a bright spot in the state's history, and not just sports history. In terms of leadership, vision, and action, Broyles earns a spot with Walton, Clinton, and Hunt, Bumpers, Pryor, and Tyson. As former president and Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton remembered this week, Broyles was a leader of character, intelligence, and determination, and on his watch, Arkansas became a leader in many sports. But a big part of his legacy came later in life, through efforts to find a cure for Alzheimer's and his support for families struggling with the disease that in 2004 claimed his wife of 59 years, Barbara. The life of Frank Broyles will be celebrated at a public memorial on Saturday, scheduled for 2 p.m. inside Bud Walton Arena on the University of Arkansas campus. This is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. 3 years ago, Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette sports editor Chip Souza helped produce a coffee table book that's quite possibly the best collection of Broyles photographs ever. There are more than 250 of them, and in the 125-page book called An Arkansas Legend, The Life and Legacy of Frank Broyles. I spoke with Souza earlier in the week about the project and the cooperation he received from the Broyles family while putting the book together.
We went to the Broyles family, and they just gave us absolute anything we wanted. We could use anything we wanted, any of the photos, anything that we wanted, and just pretty much kind of stayed back and let us kind of do this book.
And did they just have all that available in the home and invited you into the home and plow through these photos? You could take them with you, or how was that process?
We did. There were like three enormous plastic tubs of photos and all kinds of correspondence and handwritten notes from Frank to his late wife, Barbara, and just everything you can imagine. It was his entire office at the foundation that was put into the boxes. So we went to Frank's home up on Lover's Lane in Fayetteville, and we spent time there. We spent time in our office. Frank came in. In fact, I got a funny story about that. A lot of the photos, I didn't know who the people were in the photos. They were, candid shots back when he was coaching here, and so we didn't really know who they were. So we brought Frank in one afternoon to help us identify the photos, a lot of people in the photos, not knowing if he could do that because Frank's, memory, he was in his 80s, and we didn't know, what kind of day he was going to have. But when we came in and we put them all up on a big flat screen TV, and as soon as they came on, Frank, he immediately said, yeah, that's so-and-so, that's Hayden Fry, that's, this. I mean, he knew exactly who these people were. And so we had gone through this for about an hour that day, and Frank's son Hank had brought him to the office. And Hank's a real estate agent, and he had an appointment to get to, and he looks at his watch. He's like, Dad, I got an appointment, you know, here. I need to get going. Frank's like, oh, don't worry about it. These boys will take me home, you know. And it was just a really cool, something I'll never forget. It was awesome to get to spend time with him like that.
Right, and that's, you've got your own signature Frank Broyles impression.
Absolutely.
As everyone and of a certain age does. When did you realize, when you were jumping into this project, when did you realize that you had really struck on a really neat idea and a great idea for this, for a book?
We know, Paul, something I didn't even know about, because I'm not from Arkansas. I didn't get here until, you know, the 2000s, so I didn't really know this. And my recollection of Frank Broyles was as an ABC, you know, college football commentator. Right. That's how I knew, you know, remembered him. I had no idea that he was a three-sport star at Georgia Tech. I had no idea about that. And he could have, in fact, he was drafted professionally to play football, to play basketball, and as a baseball player. So that was to me an eye-opening thing. Like, wow, this, you know, we think of Frank Broyles as just, you know, the guy who's, you know, been the AD here, but he had just a tremendous life before he ever got to Arkansas.
Right, and it's got to be rewarding to put that into a book to give to people that didn't understand the history
of more than
just a football coach.
Absolutely, it was, and I'm sure, you know, I'm not the only one who was educated by that. So that's what I thought was kind of the most, you know, the neatest thing about it was the things I didn't know that now I was able to get, you know, that kind of infinite knowledge on.
How did you determine what goes in, what's left out? I mean, we're talking about Frank Broyles and his career, and as you mentioned, a well-documented three-sport, wonderful All-American athlete to accomplished administrator, broadcaster, coach, and everything in between. How did you decide what made it into the book and didn't go into a 400-page book, which I'm sure is something you could have produced as well with the content?
Right. Well, we felt like we wanted to hit the most important things that people didn't really know about. I mean, there's been books about what Frank did as a football coach, and there's been books and statue for him,
right,
for what he did as an AD. But like I said, a lot of what people didn't know was the early part. They didn't know that when Frank was in high school, he went to one school on one side of the street and Barbara went to another school, and he just happened to see her at school one day and sought her out, and she was dating someone else, and he basically pulled the other guy aside and right. So, and that was a funny story, you know, that he right. told, and that's how he, you know, he and Barbara got together. Is he knew she was the one for him, and so that's something a lot of people, unless you were really tight with the Broyles family, you wouldn't know that.
Right.
So we tried to maybe hit on those things first and foremost and give big play to things that people didn't really know that much about him, and then we kind of spent the end of the book documenting the career that everybody here knows about.
As a member of the sports media here in Northwest Arkansas, do you have a favorite recollection of Coach Broyles?
I'll tell you one of the first things I remember about Frank Broyles. I came here in 2004 in January. It was basketball season, and it was Stan Heath's first year. And back in those days at Bud Walton Arena, the press sat right on the floor, not up in the rafters like we are now, but they right on the floor. And Frank sat right behind us. And during games, Frank would coach hard, you know, from the seats behind us. And he would, you know, I mean, he was, you know, it was great. And so you would turn around, you know, and he would be, I mean, he was just coaching as hard as he could coach, you know, from the stands. And that was kind of my first, you know, time to really see him.
That's Chip Souza, who is the sports editor of the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Souza also shared his opinion on what he believes is Broyles' most enduring legacy at Arkansas. For more on that, be sure and check out the full interview on our sister website at talkbusiness.net. When we come back, Frank Broyles as fundraiser. It may have been his best talent. I'll explain next.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom, providing voice and data solutions that adapt to today's demand with tomorrow's technology. Communication tools that integrate mobility with the desktop
and merge wired networks with the wireless technology. More at one-comm.com or 479-715-8800.
During his time as athletic director from 1973 to 2007, Frank Broyles oversaw the construction and renovation of all athletic facilities on campus. That included the renovation of Donald W. Reynolds Razorback Stadium and the construction of Bud Walton Arena and Baum Stadium. All told, there was more than $215 million invested in facilities, and all of it was paid through private donations solicited personally by Frank Broyles. Just one of the many enduring legacies of an Arkansas icon. And that's all the time we have today. For the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series continues with Six Strings, Six Stories, tracing the lineage of the jazz guitar with the Alex Wentz Trio. This performance is this Saturday night at 8 at the Haxton Road Studio in Bentonville. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Lamb. That's right, Lamb, Arkansas, home of Turkey Track Bluegrass Park in Scott County. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. We end our show today with music from Handmade Moments. They'll be back in Northwest Arkansas Tuesday night performing at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks for a free concert as part of the BGO's Tyson Tuesday Nights. It's from 5 to 9. It's free. More information at bgozarks.org or at the Facebook page for Handmade Moments. This is the song Home Sweet Home Again from Handmade Moments, recorded at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Thanks so much for spending time with us. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF.
When you need a friend, feel me in your hands. Go find a glorious view of the setting sun. Excuses and reasons why you can't go.
Go. Go. Get out of here. Go. Get on now.